Well, good morning to you all. What a blessing it is to have you worshiping the Lord with us together today. And my prayer down through this week is, Lord, plug up my tear ducts for today only, just for today. Because some of what I have to share with you is rather traumatic and dramatic, and it's enough to bring tears to my eyes. And so I'm just praying for strength that God will help me make my way through this morning. What a crowd of people. I'll introduce a few of them as we make our way through this experience this morning. But before I even start, I'm holding a picture here. I know you can't see it. It's a picture of the three medics who transported me from Lewisburg to Geisinger that morning of November 29th. And I'll introduce those ladies to you in a moment. But we have doctors here with us this morning, nurses, more than just the medics, nurses, my own daughter-in-law who come to see me in Geisinger one day, and I guess from what they tell me, my face was swollen, my neck was swollen, and they were trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and she told one doctor who came in, he's leaking air. That's what she said, he's leaking air. And I was, and I'll tell you what happened there too in just a little bit. But I want to begin by saying to all of you, thanks for praying. Thank you for praying specifically for me. And thank you to all of you who called on the phone and stopped in to see me from time to time as I was recovering. And thank you to all who brought food into our home. It was very much appreciated. Not so much by me, but by my wife. But I enjoyed it too, believe me. And I want to say, don't stop praying for me just because I'm standing in front of you today, but don't stop praying for me because I still have some rehab and recovery ahead of me. Now, why am I sharing my medical experience with you today? Well, my experience has been and is known as a medical marvel if you look at it strictly from the medical point of view, because the success rate of survival from an injury like I experienced is quite low. I have talked to a number of different people in the medical field since this all happened, and they look at me and they say, and you're standing here talking to me? I say, yes, I am. They tell me, you're one of the lucky ones. No, I am one of the blessed ones, and I appreciate what God has done for me. But I look at my experience not as a medical measure, marvel, but as a miracle from God. And heaven heard your prayers for me. In the book of James, the brother of James writes in chapter 5, verses 14, 15, and 16, James says, if any one of you is sick, pray over him in the name of the Lord, and the prayer offered in faith will make the sick person well. The Lord will raise him up. And that is the reason I am here before you today. Heaven heard your prayers and raised me up. I will share with you the dramatic events that took place in those 14 days of my life. But I want to share more with you about how the Lord intervened in my life. I will, of course, talk a whole lot about me because I was, in a sense, the victim, but I think of myself more as an instrument or a vessel because I have been able to share my story and what God has done for me with a lot of people. Some of you are in the congregation this morning, but I've shared my story with a lot of people who are not here this morning, and people walk away with tears in their eyes. I believe I was chosen as this instrument or vessel to carry the message of God's great healing power to all who are willing to listen to my story. Why God chose me for this purpose, I don't know. Nor do I question God that I was chosen for this purpose. I accept it as part of God's plan for my life. And I praise him for being with me through it all. I'm sure most of you have heard the poem entitled Footprints. The poem tells a story about a man who died and went to heaven, and the Lord showed him the pathway the man walked in this life here on earth. The man saw two sets of footprints in the sands of time. One set his own, and the other the set of the footprints of Jesus who walked with him by his side. Now, there were times in this man's life when he struggled, as we do. And the man asked the Lord, why do I only see that one set of footprints in my life when during those times I needed you the most? And the Lord replied, the one set of footprints are mine, and it was in those times that I carried you. My story is about that one set of footprints on the pathway of life that I have walked. I want to tell you my story. I want to tell it to you who recognize that one set of footprints in your own life. They are the times when Jesus carried you. I know there's many of you here, probably every one of you here today, can look back over your life and see just one set of footprints and know that the Lord has carried you. I share my story with you who are Christians because I think it will strengthen your faith and your encouragement in the Lord, your trust in him. And if you are not a Christian, I hope my story will encourage you to seek the Lord and begin a relationship with him. My story may not be as dramatic as some you have heard in your lifetime, but I believe it will help you to see that there is nothing that is too hard for our Lord. He is the great physician. So here we go. I entitled this testimony as another miracle in my life. 14 days in the balance between life and death. On November 29th of 2016, I arrived at work about a quarter of six, 20 minutes of six in the morning, started the truck, filled out the driver's log, started to do the pre-trip inspection. Some of you are familiar with that. Do that on the truck before you leave every day. Everything was okay. Everything was fine. All the lights worked, believe it or not. The truck and myself, we were both okay. So I put the tools away and I walked toward the warehouse to tell the warehouse man that I was ready to leave now. Everything is still normal. Everything is still okay as I walk toward the warehouse. I feel well until I reach the landing, which is six steps above the parking lot level. And that is when my world, as I knew it that day, fell apart. After 39 years working construction for the telephone company, I'd started driving tractor-trailer for Wenger's Grocery. And I tell everybody, even to this day, that it's the easiest job I ever had. I don't mean to hurt any of you truck drivers out there, but it's the easiest thing I ever had to do. I had been driving by this point in time 7 years. And when someone would ask me, how long do you plan to drive? Because now I'm actually 73 years old. And my answer would be, well, till I'm age 80, if my health holds up. Well, so far, so good until Tuesday morning, November the 29th. So when I reached the landing outside the door that leads into the warehouse, I felt like someone hit me with an axe right between the shoulder blades. I couldn't breathe. My vision become blurred immediately. It was a cutting, burning, tearing feeling that was unbelievably strong. So I grabbed a hold of the railing on that landing, and I hung on, and I'm gasping for air. I just could not get enough air in me. And I felt like I was going to pass out, but I didn't. So after standing there trying to regain and recover. I grabbed the door handle on the warehouse only to find that it was locked. I thought to myself, of all times, why is this door locked today? So I go down that six-step stairs, walk out between two tractor trailers, around the front end of the trash compactor dumpster, up a ramp, across a landing, or started to walk across a landing that is about 50 feet in distance, got about halfway across that landing, and I couldn't go anymore. I was completely exhausted, completely out of breath. I placed my hands on my knees, trying to get air into me. I couldn't. So I thought, well, if I stand up, maybe it will make more room for my lungs. So I stood up as best I could. And again, after a few minutes, probably, I'm not sure how long, I make my way over to the warehouse door. I walked in the warehouse and saw through my blurred vision Jason, the warehouse supervisor. And after briefly discussing my condition with Jason, I pulled out my cell phone and called my wife. That's a good thing to do, isn't it? When you're in trouble, you call your wife. In brief, she said to me, "What is wrong with you?" Evidently, she could hear in the tone of my voice that there was something radically wrong. I said to her, "Well, I don't know for sure, but I may be having a heart attack." I also asked her what her symptoms were when she had her heart attack quite a few years ago now. So she began to tell me what her symptoms were, but her symptoms didn't relate to me. I said, "I'm still planning to try and do that truck run to York, Pennsylvania." The plan for that day was, it was the second day of deer season. I was the only one driving that day. The plan was that I'd take an empty trailer to York, drop that empty, pick up a load, come back to Mifflinburg, drop that loaded trailer, pick up another empty, go back to York, drop that empty, pick up a load, and come back to Mifflinburg. And it's not that bad a deal. Probably would have only been about a 12-hour day if things would go well. So after talking to Jason a few minutes and experiencing severe pain, I told him, "Jason, I don't think I can do this run today." And he says, "I took my cap off and the sweat was trapped in the hat, in the band of my hat, and literally dropped on the floor, and I could feel it running down my neck." And he tells me, but I don't remember, he says, "I told him I shouldn't be sweating like this. No, I shouldn't be." So I call Nancy back again on the phone, and this time she is up and about, of course, and I tell her, "I'm coming home. Get dressed because you need to take me to the emergency room." So I exit the warehouse through the locked door, which didn't let me in just minutes earlier. I go down that six steps of stairs, walk out between the two trailers to where the tractor trailer that I was going to run that day was running and ready to go. I climbed up in the truck, shut off all the lights, turned the engine off, and got out of the truck and locked the truck door. I then walked to my pickup truck. I got in and drove home with very blurred vision. As I got near to the garage, I pushed the door opener button. And my vision not only blurred, but it just closed in. My vision was very narrow. I also realized that my vision was so blurred, I couldn't see the front corners, the hood on my pickup truck. So I supposed that if I watch the driver's side mirror on my truck, I could manage to slide that mirror past the door opening, I should be okay. Well, I made it. I walk in the house and Nancy asks me, are you okay? And from that time forward, I don't remember a whole lot. There are many things from that time forward I don't remember. Well, when Nancy is dressed and ready to go, she tells me that I walked out to the garage and got in the car. I don't remember. I don't remember the trip to the ER in Lewisburg. But when we arrive, she says to me, "We are here. Do you need help to get inside?" I opened my eyes enough to look out the door window, and I saw the emergency room doors, and I tell her, no, I think I can make it. I got out of the car, and I walk in under my own strength. The receptionist says to me, may I help you? Which I guess she knew she could. But she says, may I help you? And I was hanging on to the countertop where you register. And I tell her, I think I'm having a heart attack. She finds a wheelchair about that quick and tells me to sit down. And I can kind of remember just like falling into that wheelchair. She takes me back to an exam room. Someone says to me, can you get in bed? Well, somehow I managed to get into the bed with the help of a couple of ER room nurses. I black out at that point in time completely. But Nancy tells me that it only took a few minutes to park the car and till she got inside, and they had already taken my work boots off, they had taken my clothes off, and I'm now wearing a hospital gown. Of course, I don't remember any of that. A doctor introduces himself as Dr. Gessner. He begins to ask me a few questions. Are you diabetic? No. Are you allergic to anything? No. Have you ever experienced anything like this before? No. Where is your pain in my back? Did you ever experience pain in your back before? Not like this. I remember him saying, we are going for an x-ray. I don't remember the ride down the hallway or being moved from the ER bed over to the x-ray table, and after the x-rays back into the bed, I am assuming, and back to my room. My next recollection is I am back in the exam room, and the doctor is shaking my shoulder, and he says to me, we are going for a CAT scan. And again, I black out. My next recollection is, once again, I'm back in the exam room. Again, the doctor awakens me and says, we are transferring you to Geisinger, but there's a problem. I said, what's the problem? He said, the weather's inclement and life flight won't fly. I said, why are we going to Geisinger? He says, because you have a problem we can't fix here. So he tells me that they are going to use a specially equipped hospital ambulance to transfer me to Geisinger. He said, I'm sending three paramedics with you, and they are about ready to go. And in that same breath, he says, well, here they come now. I have a picture of the three paramedics right here before me. I remember them rolling me out of the exam room, and somewhere in the hallway, I opened my eyes enough. I guess Nancy, she was there in the hallway, and she stopped them, or they were courteous enough to stop and let her say a word to me. But I opened my eyes enough to see Jennifer Yawn, who works as an ER room doctor, and she was talking with Nancy. And later on, I found out that when Jennifer learned of my condition, she texted her father, Jeff Yawn, and said, because of HIPAA, she did not reveal any names or information. We just have a sick person. They need prayer. Start the prayer chain. I don't remember being loaded in the ambulance, but as we were traveling toward Geisinger, I felt a rough spot in the road, and I kind of thought that it was the railroad crossing in Milton, because I heard one of the medics say something about Route 642, and my mind, I was still able to have enough brain left to realize that 642 runs out through Milton over to Potts Grove and eventually into Danville. But about 3 weeks ago, I want to break away from the story here just for a moment. About 3 weeks ago, I was doing cardiac rehab in Lewisburg Hospital. And as I look up, not further than from here to the front seat from me, come three medics. And when you're doing cardiac rehab, they put four stickers on you, whatever they are. That's one of them right there, two of them. Where's the third one? She didn't make it. Okay, well, I want you two ladies to stand up anyhow for a moment. Just stand up, Mel and Paula. Mel and Paula. And these are two of the ladies that transferred me to Geisinger, and I have their picture right here with me. But I was talking to them about, first of all, when they come in, it kind of startled me because I had this electronic device on me, and when you're in cardiac rehab, they're tracking everything that you do. And I thought, somebody's looking at a screen. You know, that was my first instant thought, that somebody's looking at a screen, and I'm in trouble. And so Mel said to me, "Are you Ralph Miller?" I said, "Yes, I am." I said, What's wrong? What's going on?" And she said, "Well, I am Mel. This is Paula, and this is Carly." She said, "We're the ones that transported you to Geisinger that morning." And so I started asking her, "Okay, ladies, thank you so much for standing. I appreciate it." But I talked to her, Mel, especially about the route we took. I told her, I said, when we hit the railroad tracks in Milton, she said, we didn't go to Milton. We went to Lewisburg, over to Montandon, out and caught 642, and then into Geisinger. And so up until 3 weeks ago, I thought we went by Milton, but we didn't. We went by Lewisburg into Montandon. So when we hit the railroad crossing in Montandon, which is a fairly rough crossing, I could hear the tires slap the rails, blah, 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 you know. And I felt the ambulance rocked, and it kind of jolted me and got me awake a little bit. And I asked Mel, I said, "How far yet?" And she said, "Not far, just hold on. We'll soon be there." And then she said to the driver, Carly, she said, "Light it up." Now, I talked to Paula, and she said when we were going through Montana, I was in extreme pain. I don't know that, but she said I was. And I guess maybe I was moving my hands around or something, and she grabbed one of my hands, and she told me that day in cardiac rehab, she said, "I'm not sure I still got my hand back." But thank you for holding my hand. I don't know about it, but thank you so much. I'm sure it helped. So Mel tells the driver to light it up, and I knew what that meant. Evidently, I'm losing the battle for life, and they needed to get me to Geisinger just as quickly as possible. And that was the last recollection I have until Wednesday evening. This whole event began Tuesday morning, and I didn't remember anything then until Wednesday evening. So from the railroad crossing in Montandon until Wednesday evening is just, it's lost time. They tell me now that the first surgery lasted 6.5 hours. They had closed, well, let me tell you a little bit about that. When I get to Geisinger, of course, all the doctors were already scheduled for surgery that day, but it just so happens that one of the doctors, the cardiac doctors, had come into the hospital that morning. He was not scheduled to work, but he came in, and he wanted to do some paperwork. He wanted to catch up on some things. And so they contacted him, and he said he would take me. He would get dressed around, and he would operate on me. And later on, I learned that it was Dr. Russell Carter, who was one of the best cardiac surgeons at Geisinger. So another blessing along the way. I hope you're keeping track of all these blessings along the way. So they had the surgery's over. They closed me up, and they're getting ready to take me back to my room, and my heart stopped. So they reopened my incision that they had just closed up. Later on, the one doctor told Bob, for those of you who don't know the family, Bob is my son, told Bob that he literally reached down into my chest and hand massaged my heart to restart it. And after they got the heart restarted, they hit me with the electric paddles and shocked me into a rhythm. So my family is informed of what is going on. They are told that they had to reopen my chest because there was a problem. My grandson Lyndon tells his mother, "I think we need to have family prayer." for Pap. Lord, I ask you to close the tear ducts for today. The family, along with the assistance of a real nice hospital nurse, found a private room, and they began to pray. Of course, I don't remember anything about the two surgeries. The second surgery lasted another 2.5 or 3 hours, so now I've been on the operating table that day for at least 8.5 or 9 hours. So after the stay and recovery, I'm eventually taken to an ICU room where there is a cardiac nurse monitoring my every move. My family is allowed to see me for the first since it all began. But I didn't know they were there. So sometime on Wednesday evening, I am aroused for the first time since the railroad crossing in Montandon. Somewhere in the interim, I thought I had died. Literally, I thought I had died. I felt like I was lying in bed. But at my feet, I saw myself lying in a glass box about the size of a large shoebox. There was bright lights all around. In the box, outside of the box, there was joyful music playing. Music that reminded me of carousel music. Just beautiful, soothing music. Again, at this point, I thought I had died. I was waiting for someone to literally come and run their hand down over my head and close my eyes, even though I couldn't see, but I was waiting for someone to close my eyes. But instead, a face appeared in front of me. It was my son, Bob. Now, you must remember, at this point in time, I was wired for sound. I don't know. I guess I looked like a Christmas tree. With ornaments just thrown on it, so to speak. I guess there was tubes and wires and monitors. I know later on in the week I got awake and somehow, and there were still 9 monitors on me with a breathing tube in my throat when I saw Bob's face. But struggling with every ounce of strength in me, I say to Bob, "Am." And I had to get a breath of air. How I talked with that breathing tube in my throat, I don't know. How he was able to decipher what I was saying, I don't know. But he says he made it out. I was legible enough for him to understand me. I said, "Am I dead?" His answer to me was, "No." I said, "Are you sure?" His answer come to me this time in 2 questions. He said, "Are you there with Pap?" referring to my dad. "No." The second question was, "Is Graham there with you?" I said, "No." You got to remember that Mom had passed away, and we had buried her about, maybe 10 days before all this happened to me. He answered me, "No, you are not dead." Then I heard Mike's voice, could not see him, but I heard Mike's voice. He said, "Pap, you had a lot of surgery. They are taking good care of you." "We are taking care of Mom and everything at home." And he bent down and he kissed me on my forehead, which I didn't remember until I was home from the hospital. So the next voice I heard was my wife. She said, "Don't leave me, hon. I need you." I remember nodding my head. I was just completely exhausted. No, I couldn't say yes, no, or whatever. I nodded my head. I don't remember anymore at that time. After several days of laying in bed in a semi-conscious state and not knowing if it was day or night, I finally begin to understand what is happening around me. I realized that I'm a very sick person. On Monday, December the 5th, I am told that my brother-in-law, Bill Cale, from Harleton, married to my sister Sharon, Sharon's there. I know, Sharon, this hurts you a little. But she had taken him to Evan. He was in critical condition. They also transferred him to Geisinger. And later on that day, that same day, December 5th, I learned that Bill had passed away. So everything from November the 29th to December the 5th is pretty much a blur. On Tuesday, December the 6th, my brother John, some of his family, maybe it was just Ryan, I don't remember, John, where are you, come to visit me at Geisinger. Sometime during that visit, all of a sudden, I don't know, five, six doctors, nurses come flying into my room. I just kind of looked at them. Now you know why I was startled when the three medics approached me 3 weeks ago because of what is about to happen. And the first doctor in my room said to me, "What's going on? What are you doing? Are you okay?" Three questions, bang, 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 just like that. I looked at John, and John goes, "You weren't much help." He didn't realize there was anything wrong with me. I didn't realize there was anything wrong with me. But about that time, there's a bunch more hospital staffers come into my room. And they begin working on me. I know they just started working on me, and I was gone. At this time, I slip into unconsciousness. I learned the next day that I had crashed. My heart had stopped again. But this time they brought me back with medication rather than opening my chest at that point in time. The next day, Wednesday, December the 7th, I remember having severe back pain while I was in and out of consciousness. They finally discovered that there is a pocket of fluid forming on my right lung, and that's where my daughter-in-law said he's leaking air. And so they tap a liter and a half of fluid from my right lung. Now, I think what happens next you will find to be very interesting. Where's Glenn Eberhardt? Glenn, there you are. That evening, Wednesday evening, December the 7th, my cousin Glenn Eberhardt and his family and one or maybe two of my sisters come to see me in the hospital. When Glenn is ready to leave, he rouses me and says, "I'd like to have prayer with you before I leave," and I'm nodding my head, "Okay." Everyone in the room gathered around my bed that night. There was a male nurse in my room, and Nancy invited him to join the circle. And at first he was reluctant. He said, "You just go." I don't know exactly what he said because I don't know about it, but whatever, he kind of pushed it off to the side. "No," she said, I want you to come and join our circle of prayer." She described the young man as a number 10, you know. He was perfect in every way. He was perfect. Listen to this. Perfect in every way. And he joined our prayer circle. And Glenn said to the family, he said, "Let's take hands." Glenn was at my left shoulder, and so I took him by his right hand, and everybody around the room took hands, and Mike was on my right side, and they had my hands. But I noticed somehow or another, got my eyes open enough to notice this male nurse in the circle. He was down by my left foot. And he didn't just reach out his hands like this to take the hand with the one next to you. He crossed his arms like this. And he took the hand of this person over here and the hand of this person over here, which I thought was a little different, but I didn't think any more of it at that point. The next morning, Thursday, December the 8th, Nancy arrived at the hospital early. She looked for this male nurse's name on the information chalkboard, which is in all the rooms, you know, it tells you today is such a day, this Tuesday or Wednesday, today's date, your nurse is so-and-so, your doctor is so-and-so, and anything that they have planned for you that day. So she didn't see a man's name there, and she asks the nurse outside of my room, again, who was monitoring my every move, did Justin go home already? The nurse looked at her and said, who? Nancy said, the male nurse that was in Ralph's room last night. The nurse says, he didn't have a male nurse last night. So-and-so, a lady, a girl, was my nurse last night. And Nancy said, Justin wasn't here last night? The nurse says, we don't have a person by the name of Justin working here. It seems, you know, as far as we know, talking with those who were in the room that night, that Justin was a guardian angel. You believe in angels? I do. I believe in angels before this, but I just reinforced my faith and belief in angels. The scriptures tell us that we entertain angels unaware. On Friday, December 9th, my doctor comes back into my room, the surgeon. He tells me that there's something wrong in my heart because the crash I took on Wednesday evening. He said, I think I know what the problem is, but I don't know where it is. Will you allow me to do a heart catheterization on you? I agree. They take me down, do the heart catheterization, brought me back to my room. That was another experience. I won't even take the time to tell you about that. Nancy tells me that it was only 15 or maybe 20 minutes later that they come for me and take and are ready to take me down for surgery. The surgery wasn't so hard this time, but they opened me up. It only took 2.5 or maybe 3 hours to make the repair. So after 3 open heart surgeries, a heart catheterization, and a lung tap, along with all the other things that they did, I survived. And 3 days later, December the 12th, I'm on my way home. Not once have I questioned the Lord as to why did you allow this to happen to me? Why did I have to go through this ordeal? But instead, I praise him for being with me through it all. There's a song we sing, through it all, I've learned to trust in Jesus, I've learned to trust in God. Through it all, I praise him for being with me. I am reminded that he said, I will never leave you or forsake you. I remember and am reminded of Job, who suffered many more things than I did in those 12 days over there. And I remember how Job refused to condemn God and die. It was more than condemn God. It was to curse God and die. Job never did it. I am not a Job, but I feel the very same way he did. The scriptures tell us that the Lord knows his sheep and his sheep know their shepherd. I encourage you to know the shepherd, Jesus. Please don't say, oh, well, I'll wait until I am in a crisis situation and then I'll cry out to him and he will come and he will hear my prayer and take care of me. It's okay if you get into that crisis situation and you're able to pray. This injury I had come upon me so fast and so furious that I didn't even have time to call on the name of the Lord for help. I was so sick that I couldn't pray. It wasn't until sometime during the next week, the second week, that I simply said to the Lord, Lord, you know me, and you know I need your help. So my question today is, how many miracles does one person get? The answer from me is, as many as it takes. As I survey my life, and I've done it lots, I still get awake now in the middle of the night. And when I get awake, I don't stay awake real long, but I rethink, I relive some of my experience, and I'm thankful to him. But as I survey my life, I see many times when there was only one set of footprints in the sand on the pathway I have walked. So today I want to claim the words from a very familiar song. To God be the glory for the great things he has done. And I want to add two words to that phrase of the song. I add those two words, for me. Those are the two words I am adding. For me, to God be the glory for the great things he has done for me. He's a great, big, wonderful God. I didn't even plan to tell you this, but I'm just going to throw it in real quick. Back, my theme song really is, Till the Storm Passes Over. Back in the year of 2013, the first Sunday morning of October, again, Nancy had taken me to the hospital, first Sunday morning of October of 2013. I was so sick, I didn't care if I lived or died. And it, long story short, this too is a whole testimony story. They found a mass on my liver the size of a tennis ball. And when the doctor come in to the room, the oncologist come into my hospital room that day, Reverend Krell was there with me. And the doctor says, does anybody in your family have cancer? Did you ever have cancer? And a couple other things, I don't know what all he said to me. He said, well, it looks like you might have cancer. And after I don't really know what the doctor said after that. I was trying to process everything that he said. But I don't really remember what he said, but after the doctors left the room that day, I looked at Reverend Krell. I said, you know what, Reverend? I don't think so. I just had a peace and an assurance. From the time he told me that you may have cancer until he left the room, I had that calmness about me. And the words to the song, till the storm passes over, till the thunder sounds no more, till the clouds roll forever from the sky, hold me fast, let me stand in the hollow of thy hand. Keep me safe till the storm passes by. I did not have cancer. I had the mass. The Lord took that away too. No surgery on that one. But the Lord is good. And I appreciate him so very much. My story. Thank you all for being here today. I appreciate you and love you all.